Welcome back to Diagram Dialogues. Jonathan Chan here, and this is part two of our panel discussions from the Diagram Media Forum. In this panel discussion, Cami leads our panelists to discuss whether patients in the APAC region are ready to be more proactive in managing their own health and well-being, and how our healthcare systems can be more patient-centric. On the panel in this session is Joe Caputo, founder of Vista Health and president of the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research in Singapore. He is joined by Anuba Taneja Mukherjee, member secretary of the Thalassemia Patients Advocacy Group in India, as well as Professor Wu Ying Ling, consultant gynecologist and oncologist at the University of Malaya in Malaysia.
So with the panel and the keynote, we've learned about the importance of value-based healthcare. This has really been hammered in, I think, by this point, and how it could be potentially achieved through various innovative approaches, whether in genomics and precision medicine as mentioned by David, point-of-care testing as mentioned by Jerry, and now digital health as you've brought up. But for all of this talk so far about value-based healthcare and how it could lead to patient-centric care, there's still one perspective that we haven't tackled, and that is that of the patients. So we now have innovations like rapid antigen tests for COVID-19, and in Malaysia, they're self-sampling cervical cancer kits. So now we know that patients are more engaged and aware than ever. So in the Asia-Pacific region, the question now is, are patients here ready to play a more proactive role in managing their own health? What can we do to support patients and healthcare systems to be more patient care ready? So tackling those questions today are Joe, once again, Anuba Taneja Mukherjee, who is the member secretary of the Thalassemia Patients Advocacy Group in India, and Professor Wu Ying Ling, who is a consultant gynecologist-oncologist at Malaysia's University of Malaya. So thank you so much for joining us today, Joe, Anuba, and Ying Ling. So let's kick off things with Joe. So just earlier, you shared that various digital technologies like IoT, telemedicine, and AI have accelerated patient access to diagnosis and disease treatment. So in APAC, would you say that patients are more ready to embrace a central role in managing health? Are there any key trends, aside from what you've shared earlier, that you can see right now?
Absolutely, Cami. And I mean, first and foremost, as mentioned, we're seeing a huge rise in the acceptability of telemedicine. And I think what the pandemic has done is really sensitized both patients and physicians alike to actually interacting in that manner through a virtual consultation. As we're seeing, there is a great deal of satisfaction and acceptance, and I believe that this is truly something that's here to stay even beyond the pandemic. I think secondly, we're seeing that patients are themselves expecting innovation and technology to play a much bigger role in their own patient care and their well-being. We're seeing greater availability of specific health apps, for instance, in mental health. We're seeing self-diagnosis apps. We're seeing monitoring apps. And I think there is certainly survey data that supports the notion that consumers in APAC and patients in APAC do expect to use more and more digital health services over the next 5 to 10 years. And finally, the other thing is I think that we're seeing the emergence of a stronger patient voice. And I think traditionally in Asia, there is a cultural acceptance that what the doctor tells you is gospel, and you should not challenge or ask questions. But I think we're seeing a move to more patients becoming more involved in their own clinical decision making. I did see some data in China, for instance, that suggested that over 30% of patients we're now asking for and getting specific drugs that they were requesting. So I think in terms of patient empowerment, I think we're seeing a more informed patient, a more demanding patient, and a patient who is more prepared to take a leading role in their own health.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. So I think that really bodes well for the future of patient-centric care in the Asia Pacific region. So that's good news. So now moving on to the perspective of the patient. So Anuba, In the patient care readiness overview that Joe shared earlier, he did say that 90% of countries reported disruptions to essential health services because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So you live with thalassemia. Did you experience any care disruptions? Could you tell us about that?
I don't know where to start because there were indeed massive disruptions, and I was just trying to sequence them. That, you know, which one should I go with first? Because for us it was double whammy, triple whammy, and I don't know how many more. Because firstly, we need fortnightly blood transfusions, so it's not something that can be catered to at home or in a home setup. And then you have so many other stakeholders, like a blood bank. You have to go to the blood bank. Then there has to be a donor in place, because if you do not have blood, so that was, I think, one of the most excruciating part of COVID. And I'm not even talking about COVID yet. I'm not talking about the infection, but I'm talking about how we got infected without getting infected by it. So, at the outset, availability of blood was a huge problem. And I can't even begin to tell you, especially people with the rare blood groups, what they went through during COVID. We went back to the drawing board, if you like, because while we as patient advocates and informed patients, like Joe said, we had started talking about sophisticated things like safe blood transfusions and, prevention of diseases like thalassemia. But here we were staring at something as basic as blood availability. So we had to take four steps backwards to get donors in the first place. Then there was a problem of getting ourselves to the blood transfusion centers. So there were lockdowns all over the country, in 2020, in the beginning of 2020. And then there was, there were layers to this problem, because people who were even able to reach to a certain blood transfusion center, which was not exactly their blood transfusion center, they were not getting the same facilities. For instance, if I was getting, let's say, a particular screening done on my blood in my blood transfusion center, I wasn't assured that I would get the same screening. For instance, if you talk about NAT, which is something that patients heavily rely on and advocate for ensuring blood safety. Because there was lockdown and one was really forced to go to a neighborhood nursing home or blood transfusion center, one could never ask for anything more than just blood transfusion to survive. So those were just some of the, very basic problems that we were dealing with. But I also want to be an optimist at heart, and being a fighter and a warrior, I would like to say that it was also a blessing in disguise, in the sense that, the way we talked about thalassemia and the quantity and quality of conversation about thalassemia that COVID saw, and that time from 2020 up until now, the way we have talked about COVID, and we've had patient audience for a change from policymakers on something like thalassemia. This is something that we've never seen before. So those are, and I would stop here for now, and probably some follow-up questions I can answer later.
Yep. So, despite everything, it seems that the whole situation at least uncovered some silver linings where, for thalassemia patients and for the government, we could start working on to improve so that this kind of situation hopefully doesn't happen again. So, thank you so much for that, Anuba. So moving on to Yinling, and now we're going for the perspective of the physician. So referencing again Joe's patient care readiness overview, a very helpful document, he did say that 70% of cancer cases in low and middle income countries are diagnosed at a late stage. And of course, that could contribute to poor health outcomes and survival rates. So for someone like yourself, how can you help ensure earlier diagnosis to improve patient health outcomes?
Thank you. Thank you, Cammy. I think we live in a very exciting time in terms of cervical cancer because we are now, most of the countries have now committed to the general call of cervical cancer elimination. So we now have the tools, the diagnostics, the treatment for cervical cancer. And it's the hope of WHO and the World Health Assembly that we will be able to eliminate this cancer as a public health problem by 2030 in our lifetime. Now, the question is, how do we reach the countries and the people who need it most? Why I say we are at a revolution now is that cervical screening no longer needs to be done using a speculum through an uncomfortable examination every year or every 3 years in your lifetime. You can now do, women can now do a swab, a self-swab, something as simple as this, twice in their lifetime. It's like a PCR test. It's like, you know, it is a PCR test. It's like a COVID test where the conversations can now happen. So although I'm a physician, the real issue with cervical cancer is demystifying how screening can be done by the women without taking time from their daily activities, from their jobs, from their work environment, looking after children. When you talk about people who are in a poverty or economic, sort of a lower economic groups, you really don't want them to take time out to go for a screening test when they're well. So a program like Program ROSE was really designed. ROSE stands for Removing the Obstacles to Cervical Screening. Really is designed with a woman's perspective in mind, how to save them time, how to remove the logistics of them coming to hospital, and to provide them with an extra help to link them to treatment should they need it. So I liken this to the travel industry. For the longest time, 20 or 30 years ago, travel industry is always, you go to a travel agent, they tell you what's best for you. Now, the person who wants to travel will customize how they want to do it by budget or at a higher level of care. It's all about the education and empowering the individual to choose health for themselves. So cervical screening has come to a point where we can now empower women to perform the test themselves in an environment where they're comfortable. But they must be provided with the right support for care when there's an abnormal screening. And that whole process requires education and empowerment, and that the physician is happy to relinquish some of that screening power to the women themselves. And I think then the physician will be doing what their value-based care, then they're doing the treatment, saving their time from screening to treatment. So I think cervical cancer is a wonderful example of enabling the population, the women, not even the patient. I call them women because they're not ill, to look after themselves and for using a value-based care, a good screening test, because abnormal screening tests will cause stress. And then the doctors then will look after them and see them through an abnormal screen.
Yeah, so I like how you positioned it as, you know, for empowerment to be possible, we also do need education. So having, you know, as you said, relinquished power and given it, placed power into the hands of these women, could you tell us maybe about the outcomes and reception to Project ROSE so far?
Yeah. So for those who are not familiar with Project ROSE is really a cervical screening program that has three components to it. Self-sampling using the swab I showed you earlier on, and the digital health, whereby the results are communicated to women through their phone. And then if there are any abnormal results, we then assist them to a hospital, organizing their appointments for them so that it navigates them through this complex hospital pathway or hospital system. And the women love it. The women absolutely say they would do this again. I mean, it's really a bit of a no-brainer having a horrible speculum examination to a self-sampling test. But we need to educate both the women and the doctors, because it's quite a radical change from looking at abnormal cells to a molecular PCR test. And I think it takes time for everyone to be comfortable and to trust the test.
So, Yinling, thank you so much for sharing that. It's nice to know that so far reception, you know, the women clearly love it. And it does seem, compared to the speculum, the very uncomfortable looking speculum that you showed earlier, I do like the idea of a swab test so much more. So maybe Joe and Anuba, before we move into the Q&A, maybe you could share any final thoughts on how patients in the Asia-Pacific region could be better equipped to play more proactive roles in their healthcare journey. So Joe, let's start with you.
Sure, Cammie. Yeah, I think first and foremost, patients can certainly be more aware of their health, their lifestyle, their how they live and how they look after themselves. I think also informing themselves of resources that are related either to specific conditions that they may have, or about sort of more health campaigns or specific health apps. And I think it's essentially shifting their own mindset from being a passive patient to a proactive or an active patient. And to be prepared to look into their conditions, to discuss those conditions with not just their GP, but everybody else in the sort of care team that may be involved, and to really, own that sort of patient journey for themselves. And I think what we're seeing is that, if we look across the industry, we're looking at a lot of companies that are sort of investing a lot of time in engaging with patients, in increasing the patient share of the voice. And I think the more that patients speak up and demand and define what value looks like to them, then the more the public health officials, the payers, the governments, and all the providers will have to sit up and take notice.
Absolutely. So, Anuba, maybe you can share, is that true as a patient advocate yourself?
No, absolutely. I would like to add that, first of all, we need to make the patient understand. And I think the greatest role that, a stakeholder group that can play in making a patient understand that you're not only a patient, like somebody said, Professor Yinling also said that I don't treat them. For cervical cancer, maybe, the perspective is different because they haven't tested yet and they are not labeled yet. But I think in case of a chronic disorder like thalassemia, hemophilia, sickle cell, even if you are medically labeled that, you are suffering from, let's say, thalassemia, you don't really have to suffer on a daily basis because, like somebody said, that science is moving faster than bureaucracy. And I think patients are moving even faster than that. And the condition is moving even faster than that. So I think you need to get out of the victim mode at the outset. That's what I would like to say, that if you start looking at yourself, not only as a patient, but if you're a lawyer, then look at yourself as a lawyer, look at yourself as a teacher, look at yourself as a woman, if you're not, if you're a homemaker. So first of all, I think you need to come out of that, phenomenon or that thought that you are a part of thalassemia. I think thalassemia is a part of your life. So first and foremost, I think that is something that as a community we should spread. And then coming to the role of community, I think somebody who can really do this is a patient himself or herself. If I, being a patient who's an empowered patient, informed patient, on a platform like this, get to speak to other patients and show my own life as an example, that this is where you can reach. You can be absolutely normal. You can be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever you want to be. And then you apply that acumen in law to thalassemia, or acumen in what you do in your house to thalassemia. Secondly, I think that governments also need to play a very pivotal role in making patients feel like partners. So partners in decision making, and not only, somebody said that I think Joe only mentioned, and he was so absolutely right, that especially in Asia, we look at doctors, you know, they're gods, and they are indeed gods for us even today. But even gods can be questioned, isn't it? So you can always ask your doctor, why are you giving me just one packet of blood if my HB is 10 grams or 9 grams? Patients don't do that. You know, if a doctor says that I can give you only one packet of blood, they wouldn't ask, is it NAT tested? I mean, you can actually get a transfusion transmitted infection like HIV, HCV, HBV. If you're given the wrong kind of blood, why wouldn't you ask that kind of a question? But I think not only on the medical side, coming to the policymaker side, the policymakers also need to understand, and this is one lesson that I bring from COVID times, hope they're over. But policymakers started considering us seriously because we were talking to media, we were drawing their attention, we were crying hoarse about the availability of blood, and they suddenly sat up and saw what we were talking about. Because so far we were just victims. We were people who were asking for reliefs all the time. Give us medicines, give us blood, give us this. We are in pain. But now what we do, and here is another solution that you should suggest solutions as well. Don't go to policymakers only with problems. Don't go to your doctors only with problems. Because you have, you know, it's your business and you know it the best. If I have joint pains, the way I can explain it to my GP, the way I can explain it to a policymaker, what safe blood means, I don't think anybody else can. So I think these are the two, three things. And then media, last but certainly not the least, especially on this platform. I think the kind of role that media has played and has the potential of playing, I think they brought us closer to the policymaker in these last 2 years. The kind of media advocacy that we as patients have done is unprecedented. So I think getting close to the media, looking for platforms, whether it be industry platforms, like you have industry bodies like the Confederation of Indian Industry and so on and so forth. If you can just identify those platforms and get out there, show up for yourself. I think these are the two, three things which should just completely change the game for you.
Yeah, that's so wonderful how you really specifically listed how, how for policymakers, for media, we can all play a role, you know, in making the thalassemia journey, at least to facilitate it rather, especially during this pandemic period. So with relation to what you were saying about, and what Joe was saying also about how in Asia, we do have a tendency to view doctors as gods, right? So, but, you know, we have physicians like Yinling who are, I guess, trying to be less godlike, if that makes sense.
I come from what Anuba calls a woman and a mother. I think that perspective is quite important.
Yep, it really does ground you, right? So I think my question basically is, you know, given all the developments that Anuba has mentioned, how do you think the relationship between patients and healthcare providers are changing now that patients are more empowered, now that we're breaking away from that notion of, you know, seeing physicians and doctors as gods?
I think patients still have quite a long way to go. For example, when patients want to have a second opinion, they don't dare to ask because they think that it will sort of upset me, but it is an absolute right of a patient. As Anuba put it, it's your body. If I get blood that's infected, I'm going to have to live with the consequences forever, my family. So from the patient's perspective, I think patients need to be empowered, need to know that they can ask questions. They can go to somewhere else. They need to know where to go if there is a question. I think the stories and the lessons learned from patient empowerment has been tremendous. And I'm starting to learn that. I've seen how our patients living with HIV have reduced the price of testing, of treatment, and to get their voices heard and to be destigmatized because they got together and they told the policymakers and their physicians how they felt. And I think that's a very powerful tool in healthcare, in value-based proper healthcare. And I think with time, hopefully different sorts of patients group will move towards that. For what many about illnesses, cancer, you may be too ill to sort of get together and get together as a group. But I hope that, you know, survivors will start combining their stories and sharing their stories and what their local needs are. Sorry, Cammy.
No worries. I just see that Nuba has raised her hand. Do you have anything to add to Yin Ling's?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I want to mention is strategic partnerships. And I also wanted to say that let the doctors be gods. I mean, what's wrong with it? But let the gods be on your side. That's the only change that you have to make, because I know so many doctors. And I think if I'm sitting here wearing a black coat, I mean, I wanted to wear a white one, but then I got hepatitis, so on and so forth. But it is because of my doctors. I would say more than my parents. It was because of my doctors. And, you know, they used to tell me, oh, you can't take this medicine. That's okay. You have an exam. That's more important. So, you know, had they not treated me like a person, like a human being, it wouldn't have been possible. So I don't have any problem in continuing to treat my doctors as gods, but I want them on my side. So I would encourage patients not to treat as policymakers as demons, is what I wanted to add. They treat policymakers as absolutely inaccessible, that, you know, the political class, for instance, your health minister, for instance, your health secretary, they are all accessible. You've chosen them. You've voted for them. So why wouldn't they listen to you? So, you know, these imaginary concepts and figments that we have in our minds. And last thing I wanted to say was that don't get on the journey alone. Probably find allies. Like I mentioned, gods being on your side. Then also get, you know, other academia, think tanks, you know, there's so many research institutes. I spoke about media already. But for instance, if I talk about India, we have premier think tanks that work very closely with the government. So they can become your linking bridge. They can route your message. So there are so many ways. And I would definitely say that doing capacity building for these patients for advocacy and how to do it. Today, we are talking about what to do. But I think getting the right folks on your side is absolutely imperative.
Yep. So thanks so much for sharing those, you know, practical tips about how to reach out to just doctors, to these think tanks and whatnot. So just one final question from the Q&A, and that is, the pandemic has increased our engagement with health topics. So how do we ensure that this engagement still continues even after the pandemic, so that patients can fully understand the importance of their role in proactively managing their own health? So maybe, Joe, you have any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I think what we've seen is a behavioral change. As I said earlier, I think we've been sensitized a lot more to health topics, to how we conduct our consultations, to how we interact with healthcare professionals. And I think beyond the pandemic, I think there's an onus on all sort of corners of the health ecosystem, on patients, on governments, on public health officials, on providers, to really all come together and really engage in that discussion around what does value look like going forward, and what does each stakeholder offer in sort of determining that sort of journey forward. There are many bigger issues beyond what we've talked about today, including things like, you know, who pays for this, who's responsible for this. Healthcare is such a fragmented industry and sector that we could talk about incentives for patients being different from incentives for providers, or being different from incentives for payers. So I think there is a broader discussion to be had. We do know that, there's a lot of talk of value-based healthcare. I think this is going to involve maybe changing how we look at value and how we pay for that value. And I think we're starting to see a shift from, volume-based payments or payments for specific conditions to more holistic payment models for, providing, an amount of money and resources that, a patient can choose when, where, and how to receive their healthcare. So I think I there's no easy answer to that. I think essentially it's incumbent on all of us to play our part, and certainly as patients, I certainly echo what Anuba said, let's not paint ourselves as the victim, as the patient. Let's put ourselves forward as a key stakeholder in this discussion and in this journey.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Joe. So it's clear that, even beyond this forum, there's still such a wide spectrum of topics that we need to tackle. For instance, the health economics, the political dimension, all that. We've only really scratched the surface today, I think. So what about you, Yinling? Do you have any just final thoughts about how you as a physician could help patients become more, proactive in managing their own health?
I think as a doctor, or as a cancer doctor, it's really made me think, the pandemic has really made me think, how we look after patients. For example, one of the natural things doctors do in a hospital is, I'll see you back in 3 months' time, just for a regular checkup. We'll do an x-ray every 3 months or a blood test every 3 months. Now, the question boils down to this, is that really needed? Does it make any difference? Is there value in doing that test? So triage and looking at once again, what's needed, what's not needed, and how we really become economical with our test and our time. That's one thing I can see that has changed in practice. And I think globally as a whole, patients and doctors and everyone else have become more familiar with molecular testing. You hear about the general public talking about CT values, PCR, and suddenly everyone has become a molecular expert. Now, we can leverage on that because many of our tests will be molecular in the future. And these are good conversations and good entry points as to where we bring our education to the next level.
Yep. So I think that just ties into what David and Jerry were discussing earlier about how, for value-based healthcare to become possible, we have to address these certain knowledge gaps. And I think because of the pandemic, it seems like some of these knowledge gaps are kind of being addressed in some way because, the molecular concepts, for instance, are really being discussed all the time in the media. PCR is now a household term, even though before it really wasn't, right? So we're seeing a lot of encouraging changes, and a lot of that is made possible by our friends in the media over here. So that is it for today's forum. Thank you so much, everyone, for your active participation. It was really my pleasure to moderate.
And that is the end of this episode. Thanks for tuning in. To find out more about Roche Diagnostics and Diagram Dialogues, please visit rochediagram.com. Stay tuned for the next episode.